You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 20th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes...
Government will be a strong government that will do what is needed. Be sure about that. Greece will be the best good surprise for everybody.
Greece swears in a new prime minister. Again. Even given that the mark he has to beat is a mere month, will Antonis Samaras last any longer than his predecessor? Ecuador's embassy to the United Kingdom finds itself catering for a perplexing house guest. Can just anyone follow Julian Assange's example and claim asylum anywhere? We'll enumerate the many reasons that the people of Copenhagen have to be so pleased with their city, and we'll discuss the present and future of documentary filmmaking.
Few people could come from where he came from and write with such passion, such vividness.
That was from one of the documentaries featuring in the Open City Docs Fest, which begins in London tomorrow. We'll be meeting the festival's director. All that, plus some music too, coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. An action-packed 60 minutes ahead as ever, but first, the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. The International Committee of the Red Cross has said today that it was preparing to evacuate wounded people and trapped civilians from the flashpoint city of Homs after both sides in the Syrian conflict agreed to its request for a temporary halt to fighting. Their spokesman Hichem Hassan said they made their request yesterday.
Well, we have officially asked yesterday, President, to go in, help people, mainly to evacuate people who are wounded and sick, women, children and elderly, and to bring in much needed help. We got the official agreement of the authorities and we got assurances from the Syrian opposition, and we hope to be able to do that as soon as possible.
A coalition of independent Egyptian judges has announced that Muslim Brotherhood candidate Mohamed Morsi has won the presidential election, according to their tally, whilst Egypt's election committee refused to give the official results from the weekend's presidential runoff before Thursday. The judges said their own tally showed the Muslim Brotherhood candidate had gained about a million more votes than his rival Ahmed Shafiq. Meanwhile, the country's former president Hosni Mubarak is believed to be critically ill. It's reported that he suffered a stroke in prison and was then transferred to a hospital. Where he's now in a coma and on a life support machine. Early reports claimed that he was clinically dead, but many people believe the statement was a deliberate ploy by the ruling military, who've given themselves greater powers. Well, Monocle's Christian Yeo, who's in Cairo, discussed this on today's edition of The Globalist.
Skeptics are saying that the announcement by SCAF, the ruling military council, is more a tactic in stopping all discussion about whether or not the military should have power, whether or not Muslim Brotherhood will move forward, or whether or not Shafiq will lead. It was to curb all of that discussion, and let's now just talk about Mubarak. At least Mubarak is dead, in a way. That's what skeptics here are saying was the thinking behind that announcement.
A suicide bomber struck a security checkpoint in Afghan city of Khost today, killing at least 16 people and wounding 30. It was the latest attack to raise questions about stability in the volatile eastern region bordering Pakistan. A spokesman for the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force said the casualties included foreign troops but declined to say how many and whether that meant deaths or injuries. World leaders have today kicked off a three-day summit on sustainable development in Rio de Janeiro, with youth leaders urging officials to act quickly to save the planet from a catastrophe. The Rio Plus 20, a follow-up of the 1992 Earth Summit, was formally opened by UN Chief Ban Ki-moon, who called on strong political commitment to pave the way for a future of more sustainable economic growth. Well, Brittany Trilford, chosen to represent the world youth, addressed leaders at the opening ceremony and called for quick action as time was running out to save the planet.
We are all aware that time is ticking, and we are quickly running out. You have 72 hours to decide the fate of your children, my children's children, and I start the clock now. I am here to fight for my future. That's why I'm here.
And finally, a rare white rhinoceros has been born in a zoo near Tel Aviv in Israel after a year and a long a year-and-a-half long pregnancy. The largest of the five remaining species of rhino left, the white rhinoceros, is the world's largest land mammal after the three species of elephant. An endangered species, South Africa lost 450 white rhinos to poaching last year. And those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's 5 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. This is Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Hong Kongist, Tokyos. Sina Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Вы слушаете Monocle 24.
Lontoosta käsin, tämä on Monaco 24.
London Bo, as a Monaco 24.
Londadan, burası Monaco 24.
Londonist, sinä Monaco 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monaco 24.
O que que nina teiro no a Monaco 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monaco 24.
Vous écoutez Monaco 24.
Das ist Monaco 24.
Du lyssnar på Monaco 24.
Kuuntelet Monaco 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 tagatja.
This is Midori House live from Studio One. Greece has a new prime minister, and that's the third time in 7 months that it has been possible to kick off a news bulletin with that announcement. The newest occupant of what might be the worst job in European politics is Antonis Samaras, former junior tennis prodigy, one-time foreign minister, and now leader of the conservative New Democracy Party. He's managed to corral a coalition including the broadly socialist PASOK and the democratic left. Well, joining us now from a ship somewhere between Paros and Athens, we have Greek entrepreneur Yason Sakanos. Good evening.
Good evening.
Now that Greece actually has a government again, is there much optimism among Greeks that, well, first of all, will this government last?
I think, to be more accurate, we have a prime minister as we speak, and we are waiting to listen to the new names of the government. And I think there's already a more positive sentiment than it used to be, like even 2 days ago, just on Sunday, 3 days ago.
Well, from the
I think we are in a better course, hopefully.
From your point of view, as somebody, you know, still trying to do business in Greece, what are the first things that a new Greek government needs to do?
That's a good question. I think they need to address the main reasons that brought us down to the crisis. This has to do with the corruption. This has to do with the mismanagement of the whole immigration policy, and it has to do with the overspending for government spending, which has been a main issue, and which has to bring the deficit under control. And this is the most difficult task, which is basically trying to take away money from a certain part of the population that was not actually working for that part. I mean, there is a certain 20%, 25% of the government sector that everybody knows that is being paid without working. So I think that will be the most difficult task to tackle.
All those things are very much easier said than done, and none of them can be done without the actual willingness and cooperation of the Greek people. Do you think there is now, I guess, a recognition among the people of Greece that sacrifices are going to have to be made?
I think this has been long the case. I mean, everybody knows that sacrifices have to be made. But when it comes to individuals and personal decisions, the people try to postpone it as much as they can. But I think people have realized that you know, the moment of truth is arriving.
It's that quite common thing, I think, of everybody thinking that everybody else has to make sacrifices.
Exactly. So I think there's a certain part of the population that has not been used to work, and it's not that big. I mean, it's 20%, maybe 25%. It's definitely not 100%. And I think it's a matter of putting these people to work, into action, or finding a way not to be costing to the rest of the society so much. And it may sound a bit simplistic, but I think it all boils down to that.
And do you think there'll be much chance of him actually pulling this off? Do you imagine that he'll still be prime minister, you know, a year from now?
That's a million-dollar question, I think. I have a feeling that in the next 12 months we will not be alone to be resolving this mess. I think now it has become, the last year was very difficult for Greece because it was as if Greece is the only bad guy in the world. I think now it's becoming apparent that you know, the rest of the South, Italy, Spain and even France, will have to tackle similar issues, which makes the party bigger, and I think decisions will have to be made at you know, at the core of the European Union. In the meantime, I mean, this is buying out time for Greece, but in the meantime, Greece has to put our own shop into order, and I hope this is what should happen in the next 12 months. If it happens, I don't see a reason for this government not to stay on for longer.
Yason Tsakanos, thank you for joining us. With that, we will let you get back to your voyage. And we're joined now by Konstantin Bahaya, a researcher at Jane Sentinel Country Risk Assessments and Greek expert. Good evening.
Good evening.
First of all, Greece's new prime minister, the third in less than a year, as we were saying, Antonis Samaras, he has a reputation as an opportunist and a populist. Is that really what Greece needs right now?
He's the first elected prime minister to form a government, just by the way, for the last over 200 days, there hasn't been an elected government. Yes, he is an opportunist. In 1993, he was a foreign minister, mm-hmm. and he resigned. It was the government had a majority of one. He resigned, the government fell, he formed his own party. He was out in the wilderness for 15 days, for 15 years after that. Then he was called back to become a Euro MP, and then he sort of hopscotched into his old party, New Democracy, and went onwards and forwards, so to speak. Yes, indeed, he can be seen as an opportunist.
He does have a very peculiar job to have to do now, doesn't he? Because on the one hand, he needs to be seen certainly at home to be leading Greece, but he also needs to do that without, I guess, making too much of the fact that he really doesn't have much say over some very crucial decisions. I believe the IMF are already demanding to send a team of experts to Greece as soon as they can.
This is the visits of the so-called Troika, including the IMF, they're regular visitors. They've kept away during the pre-electoral period, but they're heading back there. Greece has the possibility to negotiate sort of a longer time, moment of grace until it pays back its the loan. But it pretty much has to pay it. It pretty much has to carry out those reforms. And no elected government in Greece, according to the Troika, it can change these facts. Therefore, his role as a prime minister is much reduced in terms of other democratic countries and Western countries.
Well, not least because he's had, you know, as a nominal conservative, he's had to put together a governing coalition with, you know, the broadly socialist party PASOK and the Democratic Left.
The New Democracy, which is his party, the left of right of centre and PASOK, they're basically the same party in terms of policies. They haven't diverged, they haven't made an iota of difference, to use the Greek letter, in Greek politics. However, they are seen very much as the establishment parties. And what they are faced with in the opposition is what I would call the streetwise parties, parties who whose members have fought in the streets, who've carried out demonstrations, and who are now in parliament, and who are against the memorandum and who are against the Troika. And he has to keep the balance and keep his government on course with the Troika. And at the same time, he has to make sure that the other parties, the opposition that is, does not upset the balance in the streets of Athens, rioting, demonstrating, or striking, basically.
After last month's parliamentary elections, there was an awful lot of slightly perfervid talk in European newspapers about the votes picked up by the extremist parties, especially the far-right Golden Dawn. The Golden Dawn and the Communist Party, between them, polled better than 10% in this election. How much should, or how little, I guess, should be read into that?
The Golden Dawn, I spoke to a few sort of members or supporters of Golden Dawn. They're basically angry at the immigration and the corruption, and there's an element of, I would say, just hooliganism in them. They are a dangerous party. They are the party who will start fistfights in the streets. They are the party who can and have promised some of the members of this to disrupt Parliament. They are not a pleasant factor in Greek politics right now.
Just finally then, and I know Greek politics is an awful lot less predictable than a lot of countries' politics just at the moment, but I mean, a year from now, do you imagine that Greece is still going to be a Eurozone member and Antonis Samaras is still going to be its prime minister?
Heavens. if I knew that answer, I'd put my money somewhere. I think I'm just going to keep it where it is. I think it'll be 100, I'm 100% certain it'll be a member of the European Union. If he can keep on course Samaras, then it will be a member of the Eurozone. And dropping out of the Eurozone is a lengthy process. It's not like, bye guys, here's the drachma, and off you go. There's a lot of legal aspects to this transition.
Konstantin Bahaya, I dare say neither of us have spoken about this for the last time. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. You're listening to Midori House, and we'll be back after this with some music and the ramifications of Julian Assange's surprise visit to Ecuador's embassy in London.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
They say money makes the world go round, and all this week on Monocle 24, we'll be taking a closer look at the notes and coins in your pockets. From the ubiquitous dollar to the creaking euro, and taking in a few more extreme examples along the way. So tune in for The Currencies every day on The Globalist and The Monocle Daily here on Monocle 24.
This is Midori House live from Studio One in London. And coming up next, the latest on the peregrinations of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who strolled into the Ecuadorian embassy in London last night and applied for asylum. By way of appropriate fanfare before that, this is Ecuadorian singer Mirella Cesar, dubbed the mother of Andy Pop, which is a thing, apparently. This is Digan Lo Que Digan. Those were panpipes. We're not sorry. That was Ecuadorian singer Mirella Cesar with Digan Lo Que Digan. And that was played by way of fanfaring our next item, which is about, well, it's not really about Ecuador, but about their embassy in London. And one would imagine that appointees to the role of ambassador to the Court of St. James for the Republic of Ecuador confidently anticipate negotiating their term without having to weather much in the way of controversy. However, Ecuador's London embassy presently finds itself sucked somewhere towards the centre of the global news vortex following yesterday's arrival on their doorstep of WikiLeaks founder and one-man media circus Julian Assange. Assange, who is an Australian citizen, has reportedly applied for asylum in Ecuador. He apparently believes this preferable to facing justice in Sweden, where he is wanted on charges including rape. Assange claims to fear further extradition to the United States, who want a word with him for leaking classified documents. Well, joining me now is John Quigley, who's a professor of international law at Ohio State University. Good evening, John.
Thank you.
First of all, what are the basic legalities of this? Is any embassy anywhere in the world obliged to hear the asylum case of anybody who asks?
Well, there is an obligation on states to consider requests for political asylum. under, I think now one can say under customary international law, a general obligation. That doesn't mean they have to grant the request by any means. And here, apparently, the Ecuadorian government is considering, but hasn't yet come to a decision.
I mean, obviously, this case is getting an extraordinary amount of attention because of the fame of the asylum seeker. But does this happen a lot without being terribly much reported? Are the world's embassies always, you know, having their doors knocked on by people trying to claim asylum in the country they represent?
It's more typical that the person will somehow find a way to get to the country in question and then ask for political asylum. It's not so common that they'll knock on the door of an embassy.
And what happened, I mean, what I'm trying to understand is basically the technicalities of how this works. Could they have told him just to clear off?
Well, they are required, as I say, to consider the request, but many states consider a request rather summarily if they find that there's no basis for it. So, I mean, they could have dealt with it rather quickly, but apparently they are taking it somewhat seriously.
And in a situation like this, what are the rights of the local police under the Vienna Conventions? Because Assange has now breached the bail conditions he was serving. There's a warrant out for his arrest. So can the Metropolitan Police go into the Ecuadorian embassy and get him?
They can't go into the embassy to get him. They can, as they are doing, wait outside in the hopes that he steps out, because once he is there, then he would not be protected. The embassy premises cannot be entered by local authorities without the consent of the country in question.
Well, as you say, the London's finest are, even as we speak, perched on the steps of the Ecuadorian embassy. So supposing for whatever reason the authorities back in Quito were inclined to look favourably upon Julian Assange's request for asylum, how would they actually get him from London to Quito without crossing the jurisdiction of the Metropolitan Police, who could presumably nick him as soon as he leaves the premises?
That is a very serious question for Ecuador and for Assange. I think there probably isn't a way that they can do it. I mean, once he is outside the embassy, he can be seized by police. You know, whether he stepped out the door, whether they would take him, you know, let's say, in a helicopter off the roof somehow. I don't know how that would be done in Knightsbridge exactly. But once he is outside the embassy premises, he could be seized. There was, in fact, a case on this issue in the International Court of Justice in 1950, where it was argued that once a country gives asylum, there is an obligation on the part of the territorial state to allow the person out of the country, but that was never really resolved. So there's probably not a right on the part of Ecuador to get him through British territory.
Because the thing is, when these high-profile cases come up, and there have been a few precedents, they do tend to get resolved by a certain amount of diplomatic fudging. I mean, we saw most recently Chang Guangcheng in the U.S. Embassy in Beijing and Wang Lijun in the U.S. consulate in Chengdu, and before that, Morgan Tsvangirai in the Dutch Embassy in Harare and Manuel Noriega in the Vatican's Embassy in Panama. But Julian Assange doesn't really have a government backing him, does he? Does the Australian government have a role to play here, or should the Australian government play a role here?
Well, it certainly does have a role as the country of nationality, and it claims that it has been providing him with consular assistance. I think he is somewhat disillusioned with what he has received in terms of help from the Australian government, but it is clearly involved here, and there clearly could be some negotiations. That is, there could be negotiations between Ecuador and the UK to allow him to proceed to an airport to get out of the country, and conceivably the Australian government could be involved in that.
But assuming that's the case, and this, I realise we're stacking hypotheticals on top of hypotheticals here, but how far can Sweden then go to, you know, press the fact that they still want to try him on charges pending against him?
Well, Sweden doesn't have much of a role in dealing with this immediate situation at the embassy, and I think the Swedish authorities have said that within the last few hours. They're hoping that he will be surrendered to Sweden, but they have to await the action of the British executive authorities in doing that. There's a possibility that Assange could go to the European Court of Human Rights, and they might have to await that as well.
And is there a time limit on cases like this, or can Assange, assuming he's, you know, bought a change of clothes and a toothbrush, stay there theoretically forever?
Well, there was an incident during the Cold War in Hungary where a Catholic prelate, Cardinal Mezenti, went into the U.S. Embassy and stayed there for 15 years. So I imagine he had quite a bit of toothpaste. But so it's possible that this could go on for some time.
I suspect that is a precedent currently being reflected upon by the ambassador from Ecuador to the Court of St. James with some dread. John Quigley of Ohio State University, thank you very much for joining us this evening. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
No mundo todo, essa é a Monocle 24.
Haule la alam, hana Monocle, arba washrin.
En todo el mundo, esto es Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong e Tokyo. Ez a Monocle 24.
Από όλο τον κόσμο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Warte rund, det här är Monocle 24.
Überall auf der Welt, das ist Monocle 24.
Der coolste Monocle Gachtung mit Nate.
Around the world, this is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour on Midori House, we'll visit one of the podium finishers in Monocle's annual Quality of Life survey. But first, the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Thanks very much. The International Committee of the Red Cross has said today that it was preparing to evacuate wounded people and trapped civilians from the flashpoint city of Homs after both sides in the Syrian conflict agreed to its request for a temporary halt to the fighting. A coalition of independent judges in Egypt has announced that the Muslim Brotherhood candidate Mohamed Morsi has won the presidential election according to their tally, which showed that he had gained about a million more votes than his rival Ahmed Shafiq. Meanwhile, the country's former president Hosni Mubarak is believed to be critically ill. It's reported that he suffered a stroke in prison and was then transferred to a hospital where he's now in a coma and on a life support machine. A suicide bomber struck a security checkpoint in Afghanistan's city of Khorst today, killing at least 16 people and wounding 30. It's the latest attack to raise questions about stability in the volatile eastern region bordering Pakistan. And world leaders have today kicked off a three-day summit on sustainable development in Rio de Janeiro, with youth leaders urging officials to act quickly to save the planet from a catastrophe. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. And every day this week on Midori House, we're visiting the victorious cities in Monocle's Quality of Life issue, which is hitting discerning newsstands nowabouts. Today, it's the turn of third place getter Copenhagen, from where we're joined by our man on Strøget, Michael Booth. Good evening, Michael.
Hi, good evening. How are you doing?
Very well. You sound appropriately chirpy because the UN is forever rating the Danes the happiest people in the world. Has that been your experience of living among them?
It's not the obvious, most obvious thing you notice about the Danes at first sight, that they're not skipping gaily down the street or anything like that. But you know, the longer I'm here, the more I have come to recognise that they've really got a few things sorted, especially in Copenhagen. That actually, I'm writing a book about kind of Danish and Nordic happiness and life quality right now, so I'm really deep into that subject, and I'm coming to the conclusion after some traumatic years living here that they actually are right, and the Danes have really got some things sorted out. And I must protest at the third place, actually. You know, what Zurich got that Copenhagen hasn't got? You say, there's nowhere to eat in Zurich, for a start. You know, it's all very well having mountains and a nice lake, but where are you going to eat?
I would agree with you entirely, but I'm not really sure where my loyalties lie in this discussion.
Okay.
I mean, as you were discussing there, you're not a native to Copenhagen. So I was wondering if you could tell me a bit about your personal experience of it. How long have you lived there, and how welcoming and amenable a place was it to move to?
Well, you know, I mean, I've lived there on and off. I had stints in Paris and elsewhere in between. But over the last 12 years, I've been coming and going to Copenhagen. And I've seen a massive change in the city since a dozen years ago. When I first moved there, it was much quieter, much less developed, much fewer, great restaurants, cool shops. They were just beginning to find their feet as this great kind of design, exciting, dynamic city. And I've watched the city flourish really over the last 12 years. And they got themselves, they pulled themselves together in terms of their tourist board. That was one of the main things that happened. They created this wonderful Copenhagen tourist board, which has been incredibly progressive and creative in promoting the city and also in orchestrating major changes in the city. The latest thing to come to the city is going to be a super arena, which they're going to be building, and which wonderful Copenhagen has been pushing for many years, and is going to be built by 2015 with a capacity of, I think, 15,000. So it's like one of the pieces of the jigsaw that Copenhagen has been missing in terms of competing internationally for big events, and now they're going to be getting that as well. So I think, for me, the story of Copenhagen is of amazing changes. I've seen the arrival of restaurant Noma and all of the incredible new Nordic food movement that's come in its wake, and that's been really exciting to see, and it's just exciting to see Copenhagen kind of waking up a bit, really, and having some ambition.
I mean, is there one particular thing that Copenhagen does, or one particular way that Copenhagen acts? I guess a lesson you would export to other cities, if you could.
Yeah, it's got to be, and it's a bit of a cliche now, but it's got to be the bicycle. Bikes are such an intrinsic part of life in Copenhagen, and it contributes so hugely to, not just public health and pollution, but just the sense of freedom in the city, the comparative lack of congestion. It just makes for a nicer city that everyone, no matter what class, what job they do, what profession, they all commute on their bikes no matter what the weather, and the weather gets pretty rotten. Maybe that's one thing that Zurich has on Copenhagen. But the bike culture, the fact that bikes take priority over everything, and they've just begun building these, they call them bike superhighways, to bring further reach commuters into the city on their bikes instead of in their cars. And they're just so progressive, and they're investing in bike infrastructure all the time. So, if you're going to export something from Copenhagen, it would have to be the bike culture, I think.
And to ask that question in reverse just quickly, when Copenhageners do complain, what do they complain about? What do they think their city could still be doing better?
Well, it's something that they can't really do any better, but they complain about anyway, and that's the size of it. It doesn't take long to have explored all of Copenhagen's nooks and crannies and, whisper it, but it can get a bit boring when you've lived there for a while and you see the same people, you go to the same bars, the same restaurants, and you can exhaust its opportunities quite quickly. It is one of the smallest capitals in Europe, but that's one of its joys and its great qualities as well. So I don't think anyone wants to change it, but, Copenhageners, they go to New York for the weekend, or they go especially to Berlin. Berlin is their escape route for that when they want to go to the bigger world,
With that, Michael Booth, we will let you go on enjoying life in Monocle's third most livable city, Copenhagen. That's Monocle's Copenhagen correspondent, Michael Booth. And as you'll find out by reading Monocle's Quality of Life issue, which you really should, 18th-placed Berlin might be ranking higher if only the city's ambitious project to build the new Willy Brandt Airport at Brandenburg had got properly off the ground. For the latest, we're joined now by a journalist based in Berlin, Andrew Curry. Good evening, Andrew.
Hi there.
This airport has been interminably delayed, obviously, and the latest is that it's now due to open in March 2013. At the risk of invoking hoary stereotypes about German efficiency, what has gone wrong here?
The architect I talked to said that the problem is this is supposed to be the largest terminal in the world, and that comes with all kinds of problems. And specifically, what happened was they needed to go with the largest terminal in the world, the largest fire safety system in the world, and they learned a month before it was supposed to open that it just wasn't going to work. So they hope they need another 6 months to work out the bugs with the fire safety systems, with luggage transport systems and stuff like that. And right now the new company that's taken over the planning after they fired the old planners have said that it's not impossible that they will be able to open on March 17th.
The press coverage of this has been predictably merciless, and indeed a recent headline in Die Tageszeitung ran, "Berlin can't get it up." Is this actually become a source of general embarrassment?
I think it's definitely embarrassing for Berlin. This sort of constant perception that Berlin is a fun place to live, but can't quite get its act together when it comes to big projects like this. It can't clean its streets as well as other big cities. It hasn't yet affected Berlin's tourist numbers. I think it's the third most popular destination in Europe still, but they definitely are having trouble. They're going to have trouble keeping that if they can't get enough planes in. And the two airports that are doing the duty right now are too small to compete with the Berlin's real competition, which is London, Paris, Rome, Munich, places like that.
I mean, to stand that question on its head a little bit, are there Berliners who were not keen on the new airport? We were doing a story quite recently on Monocle 24 about the fact that the people of Munich have voted against a third runway for their airport and that there's no more night flights allowed in Frankfurt. And one of the hiccups, obviously, with this airport has been the redoing of soundproofing on 2,000 new flats near the airport, because airport noise can't be louder than 55 decibels inside the flats when the windows are closed. Is it just that Germans have sort of got tired of living close to airports?
Well, the airport is an interesting... The airport's... It's the Berlin-Brandenburg airport. And there's always this divide between Berlin and Brandenburg, which is the state around it. And the airport happens to be outside of Berlin, and Berlin's neighbors kind of resent the fact that Berlin is exporting all its problems to Brandenburg. And it's the Brandenburg courts that have been particularly stringent about the regulations and really put the airport planners' feet to the fire when it comes to the promises they made on soundproofing and safety and stuff like that. So I think Berliners don't really care about the airport noise, but it's the people who live around it that are putting up as many roadblocks as possible, even though it's a foregone conclusion that it'll come at some point. As you said, costs are overrunning in terms of soundproofing flats around it. It's closer to 14,000, actually, that could be affected rather than 2,000.
Andrew Curry in Berlin, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we'll be back right after this with an interview of the director of London's Open City Docks Festival.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly business briefing, looking at the most inspiring people, places and ideas from around the world. Whether it's a bookshop owner in Toronto with a smart new business model, a fast food entrepreneur taking Japan by storm, or a local bank CEO providing microfinancing in Kenya, our correspondents and editors are on hand to provide insight into self-started success. Each week we'll be talking to enterprising people who have taken the leap and followed their dreams to set out on their own.
This is not just purely a business. This is a lifestyle. It's fun. It's great. I wake up in the morning, every morning, excited about what are these crazy ideas going around in my head.
From branding your company to finding startup financing and surviving the tough times, we cover the full range of what it takes to turn an idea into a thriving business. All told through personal stories from real people finding success by following their ambitions.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House. For 3 days starting tomorrow, London will host the second Open City Docs Festival, a celebration of the best in documentary filmmaking. The festival will open with Matthew Acker's The Artist Is Present, his study of Marina Abramovic, and screen more than 100 further documentaries, including studies of brain disorders, a chronicle of one man's quest to meet Metallica's drummer, it takes all sorts, and McCullen, a new documentary on the legendary war photographer Don McCullen. Well, joining me now is Michael Stewart, director of the Open City Docs Festival. Welcome.
Good evening.
This is the second year of the festival. Why did it begin? Why did you feel there was the need for a documentary festival?
I thought that in London, we have a wonderful fictional documentary, a fictional festival, London Film Festival, which has been going for generations now. And we've never had a festival dedicated to documentary film in a hub over a number of days, bringing filmmakers and audiences together in the way the London Film Festival does, but resolutely focused on documentary film. Yep. And that was a kind of gap in the market. There are, of course, elsewhere in Britain. There's a wonderful festival up in Sheffield. Mm. But that's a long way away from London, and that has a strong broadcast and an element of kind of an element of selling films, bringing purchasers and filmmakers together, as well as a public side. We wanted something that was completely uncommercial, had a much broader range than broadcast film, so we'd show artists moving image as well as material that has been or will go on television. And we wanted it to be in one place. So we bring together the different audiences that go to documentary films. I mean, you probably know that documentary often is rather niched, so that people will go to see green films or science films or whatever. So we want to bring those different audiences together. So we've got films for deaf people signed with signed interpretation through the films and the panel discussions. We've got films for school kids, bringing all those different audiences together in one place in London, in a sense recreating the city in miniature through having a documentary festival.
That is a diverse assemblage of films, obviously, but was there a particular quality you were looking for in choosing the films? Was there one thing they all had to have?
There is something. They all have to be beautiful films, as films. They all have to say something important and distinctive and original. And we are very concerned, or I've been concerned for years, that there's been a increasing restriction of what counts as documentary on broadcast television. So what gets shown and what gets investigated through documentary, what gets funded. And we wanted to create a place in the city where a much broader range of documentary work got exposed.
What's an example of something that the festival will be screening that wouldn't make it past the commissioning editors of mainstream television?
Really quite a lot of what we're showing these days. I mean, the film Mission to Lars, this absolutely charming film that's on in a few cinemas around the country at the moment and which we're screening at the weekend together with the filmmaker and one of the doctors involved in treating people with this form of autism called Fragile X syndrome. That's a film that people just turned down. They weren't interested in funding because Kate Spicer, the lead character and the sister of the man in the film, wasn't deemed to be charming enough to lead the film. Now, I mean, in a sense, that's the point of the film, and in one sense. So really, I mean, much over half of the films we're showing are things that might one day have got a broadcast outing, but certainly wouldn't today in the very restricted canon that gets on television. I mean, that said, we also show some of the great stuff that's been on television. We're very happy to put stuff up that people, you know, people may or may not have seen, but then we bring the directors in, we create conversations. That's one of the other things I think that makes this festival really, I mean, distinct in a sense. That, I mean, apart from the fact that we, you know, we avoid the red carpet, we avoid the kind of some of the more off-putting celebrity aspects of some film festivals, is that whenever we have a panel, we try not just to have the filmmakers there, but to have other people, either from the film or from the background to the film, to broaden the conversation so that people won't talk about aspect ratios and lenses and stuff like that, but they'll talk about what the film's about in a sense, or what, you know, why the film means something.
There's a particular strand or a dedicated strand of protest works which includes films from datelines including Tahrir Square and rather closer to where your screening rooms are, Tottenham. Where is the divide though, do you think, between documentary and agitprop?
One of the points of the festival is to, especially this year, we've kind of made it, became more explicit, is to think about what are the limits of documentary, to explore that. So we are housing an exhibition of photographs with the London Festival of Photography found in Gaddafi's archives, many of which are staged photographs, of course, so they're not really, what are they documents of? Equally well, some of the films we're showing are engaged films. They're arguing a case. They're the edge of documentary, but that's, you know, that's why we're showing them, because it provokes interesting debates. In fact, one of the films we're showing, The Real Social Network, is filmed inside University College London itself, which is the host for this festival.
Do you think that documentary filmmaking as an art form or as a craft, I guess, is reasonably healthy, or is it suffering from the same crisis that we're seeing in print journalism, this belief, and I prefer to think, a mistaken one, that nobody wants the long form stuff anymore, that the audience doesn't have any patience anymore.
Financially, it is hard to raise money for documentary film. Now, that said, there is an enormous amount of documentary film being made. I mean, documentary filmmakers are poorer than they used to be. Mm. It's much harder. The real area, I think, where there's a crisis, and this is, in a sense, why I created this organisation, Open City Docs, which produces the festival, but does a whole series of other things as well, is to train and nurture and cultivate the next generation of filmmaker. And that's what's gone. I was talking with senior management at the BBC the other day, confessing that, in effect, the BBC has abandoned the training of young documentary makers. That's true for ITV as well. Channel 4 recently has formed a link up with National Film and Television School, an interesting move. But I think that we're stepping into that area and saying we need to create spaces where documentarists can flourish, because I mean, fundamentally, the heart of, you know, this festival is the belief that in the kind of society, rapidly changing society we live in, where you don't know your neighbours, you have to have documentary films to build the kind of empathy and understanding that you need just to kind of, just to get through the week, let alone the year.
Michael Stewart, director of the Open City Docs Festival, launching in London tomorrow. Thank you very much for coming in this evening. You're listening to Midori House. Among the performers at the festival will be the London-based singer Fiona Bevan. This is her with The Balance from her album Plant Your Heart. That was Fiona Bevan with The Balance. Now, every day on Midori House, we summon one of Monocle's section editors to talk about what is occurring on their bailiwick. It's Wednesday, which means it's the turn of foreign editor Steve Bloomfield, who, in keeping with his job description, is somewhere foreign. Specifically, he's in Piran on the border that divides Croatia and Slovenia, and where I, for one, hope the weather is just dreadful. Good evening, Steve.
Andrew, I'm very sorry. The weather's actually rather lovely here. It's another beautiful day on the Adriatic coast. I'm in Piran, which is just inside Slovenia. I'm standing right by the sea, and I can see Croatia across the bay. So if you were to live in Slovenia, in this part of the country, you could literally say you see Croatia from your house.
Okay, well, we'll leave the gloating about the weather to one side. Tell us a little bit about what has brought you to Piran. What's the story?
Well, all this week I'm travelling up this coast. I was in Croatia yesterday. I'm going to be in Italy, in Trieste tomorrow. And the reason that we're here is to look at how Slovenia is a country with the tiniest coast in all of Europe. And it's a coast that's actually still quite heated. Croatia, that, as I say, I can see from where I'm standing right here, has laid claim to parts of this coast for quite some time, and it's a claim that's caused some problems for Croatia's EU accession.
Well, this is the Piran border dispute. Now, is this one of those disputes that actually genuinely matters, or is it one of those arcane European geographical rows that nobody sane really cares about?
Well, it matters if you're a fisherman on either side of the border. It matters certainly if you're a politician in Slovenia or Croatia and you want to boost your nationalist credentials. The dispute itself, like all good disputes, kind of depends on which of the two opening sentences in Article 15 of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea you want to refer to. If you believe that the first sentence, which is all about equal distance from the shore, is the one that matters, then you're on Croatia's side. And if you read the second sentence, which is about, yes, but what if there's a historical title, then you're on Slovenia's side.
This is, of course, a dispute that lay dormant for years when both Slovenia and Croatia were part of one country. Since it has flared up, since they both became independent in the early to mid-90s, how serious or rancorous has it become?
Well, it became an issue really mainly when Croatia wanted to join the EU. Slovenia joined the EU in 2004. They were, the only country in the Balkans to join when there was a great wave of enlargement to the European Union in 2004. And when Croatia tried to join after that, this issue over where the border lay became a far bigger political problem. It's almost sorted now in that both sides have accepted the need for international arbitration. And they have both said that they will accept what those international judges, plus one judge from Slovenia, one from Croatia, actually decide. And the Croatia's EU accession now seems to be on track. It's been approved. They will become the 28th member. And I think one of the things that I find interesting about this is that it just proves how important smaller countries in Europe still see membership of the European Union. They still see it as an enormous sort of, you know, turbo boost to their economy. And, you know, just from, you know, crossing the border between the two countries, as we did earlier today, you can see the difference that, you know, EU membership really makes to a country.
So where's next on your Balkan road trip?
We're in Piran today. Tomorrow morning we go up the coast to Koper, still in Slovenia, which is becoming an increasingly important port, which is also giving access to, for Austria. And then by the end of the evening, we should be in across the border into Italy, in Trieste. So when I speak to you or whoever is hosting tomorrow night's Midori House...
That's me, I'm afraid.
I'll be speaking to you from Trieste.
Okay, well, with a bit of luck, you know, that's 24 hours for clouds to gather and the heavens to open and plagues of frogs to rain from the skies and zombies to rise up and roam the streets. So that's Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for joining us in Piran, which is in either Croatia or Slovenia, depending on who you're asking. And you're listening to Midori House. And that's all we have time for today. So thanks to our producer, Marcus Hippie, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Alex Jakes. Up next after the news, it's this week's episode of our business show, The Entrepreneurs. We'll look at the reasons why Israel's tech scene is booming.
Israeli companies are tremendous technologists, really at a level that I don't even see in the valley in terms of consistency of technical prowess.
The Entrepreneurs will also sit down with the CEO of British heritage brand William & Son and chat with the co-author of the new book Meta Luxury. So stay tuned for that. In 3 hours' time, that's 2200 hours here in London, Chloe Potter and Emma Nelson will be back for the Monocle Daily. And if you've missed any of our programmes or want to hear something again, it's all on iTunes, on our website or via our mobile app. I'm Andrew Muller. I'll be back with Midori House the same time tomorrow. Good night.